Welcome to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and usually on the show, we bring you a whole bunch of stories on the many kinds of things you see around the D.C. region, from the historical to the current to the out-and-out quirky. Well, this week, we're bringing you stories on the many kinds of things you may not see unless you look very, very carefully. We're calling the show Below the Surface. Over the next hour, we'll seek out bull sharks in the Potomac River.
You know, they have almost like a bump and push tactic when they go to feed.
And we'll visit a burial ground for contrabands.
If you were driving by here, you would have no idea about the over 1,700 men, women, and children who are buried in here.
Plus, we'll explore the hidden lives of hoarders and learn why reclaimed strip mines might literally be going to the birds.
People from downstate who were never exposed to this probably wouldn't look at this and say this was a reclaimed mine. They might actually say this was probably part of a farm.
We'll start off today's Below the Surface show at the bottom.
Over there, that's where the burial ground is. This is the Lumpkins Jail site in here. And then the site that they're planning for the stadium itself is on the other side of the railroad tracks.
Shaco Bottom, that is, on the east side of downtown Richmond, Virginia, where Anna Edwards' personal history runs deep.
I know that two of my great-great-great-great-great-grandmothers were sold out of Richmond in the 1840s.
And the African Burial Ground, as it's known, and Lumpkins Slave Jail were a part of that. Because from 1830 through 1865, Shaco Bottom was the nation's second largest slave trading center.
After New Orleans?
After New Orleans, right. So it would have been full of slave trading houses and then supporting businesses. So if you were a grocer or you were a dry goods person or if you were a seamstress or if you are the blacksmith, and there are going to be lots of those.
Since then, though, the original 8x12 block village has been torn down and paved over numerous times. Nowadays, it's mainly a hodgepodge of storefronts, many vacant, and parking lots, which is where that stadium comes in that Edwards mentioned. In November, Richmond Mayor Dwight Jones unveiled a development project known as Revitalize RVA. That's RVA as in Richmond, Virginia. The $200 million plan would include a 7,000-seat minor league baseball stadium, a hotel, a grocery store, retail office and residential space, and parking garages.
In addition, it may allow us to build a ramp that will ameliorate the inability to move people in and out should there be a disastrous flood.
But Edwards, who chairs the Sacred Ground Historical Reclamation Project
of the Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality,
worries the new development will jeopardize what she sees as the sacred ground of Shaco Bottom, like Lumpkins Jail, the so-called Devil's Half Acre. During an excavation in 2008, researchers uncovered hand-painted china, children's toys, and the foundation of the 2.5-story brick building where people were imprisoned and tortured.
And when you talk about Lumpkins Jail, but also the burial ground, which is on the north side of Broad Street, that was the oldest municipal cemetery that allowed black people to be buried in it.
But today, Lumpkins Jail is more or less a grassy field, and as for the African burial ground,
the burial ground is over there barely being protected by the fact that they did at least take the asphalt off of it because it was a parking lot until 2011. But the most generic of signage is there. It says historic burial ground, but that's it. So why should we be nervous? Maybe because there's a history.
And she's not alone.
We look closely at a place like this and we say that Shaco Bottom should be treated as a site of conscience.
Rob Niewegg is with the National Trust for Historic Preservation, which included Shaco Bottom on its 2014 list of the 11 most endangered historical places in the United States. If Shaco Bottom is developed, he says, the most appropriate way isn't with a baseball stadium.
A 7,000-seat baseball stadium is not something that one can sensitively set in an archaeological site. So first, the large footprints is problematic. And especially if one sees this through the lens of the descendant community, of the people who feel a strong, direct, familial connection to those who suffered there, it's very hard to find the connection between baseball and commemoration of slavery.
Now, to be fair, Revitalize RVA does promise to privately raise $30 million for a slavery heritage museum in Chaco Bottom, what Mayoral Chief of Staff Grant Neely calls
the first proper commemoration of the history of the slave trade in Virginia.
But the main motivation for developing Chaco Bottom, he says, is the city's bottom line. After all, they could tear down the existing stadium, which occupies a prime 60 acres on the other side of downtown,
and make it possible to do retail, apartments, restaurants, you know, residential office space, that kind of stuff.
And they could do the same in Chaco Bottom.
When you put new residential spaces down there and a hotel, then suddenly you transform this area that is blighted and you turn it into a place where lots of people are hanging out.
In turn, then, you generate more revenue for the city. That's why Neely says a number of local groups,
the Chaco Business Association and the Chaco Neighborhood Association, the Chaco Partnership,
strongly support Revitalize RVA. But opponents have their own visions for Chaco Bottom.
What I'd like to see is a museum to cover that whole area, because I'm sure there's a lot of artifact that's there as well.
Justin Dixon Northup Gilliam is the great-great-great-great-grandson of one of the most well-known individuals to pass through Chaco Bottom, 12 years a slave memoirist Solomon Northup.
The pen that Solomon was held in is actually a parking lot now. No, it actually kind of extended out into the street as well. So you're driving over it every day and not even knowing what type of history that you're just passing by. And that's the type of history that's supposed to be preserved.
I met up with Gilliam in Northwest D.C. outside the Newseum, former site of the National Hotel, which is where Solomon was kidnapped and sold into slavery. As CEO of the Solomon Northup Foundation, Gilliam works to promote Solomon's legacy. That's why he's attended various events protesting the baseball stadium in Chaco Bottom.
I have a four-year-old daughter. And she came with me to the first event. So you can look on our website, for instance, and see her holding a no build on Chaco. You know, it's that important to me to be able to take her places and kind of see the things that generations before her saw.
Anna Edwards says what the Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality would like to see is a sacred ground memorial district, an 8-square-block commemorative park. And to help spark economic development in Chaco Bottom, surrounding the park, they would actually welcome many components in the mayor's proposal. Just not the baseball stadium, with its potential for destroying whatever artifacts still lie beneath the ground, left over from the days of slavery.
The Black community's voice needs to be heard in a city where it's always been at least half, if not the majority, of the population. And yet when you look around, you don't see evidence of that history here. And I know there is a statue to Bill Bojangles Robinson, and he was an amazing man. And I know that there is the bust of Oliver Hill, who was an amazing civil rights leader. But in the world picture of Richmond, the symbol that represents this city is a silhouette of the statue of Robert E. Lee. Janine Bell, who's with the Olegba Folklore Society, put it very well in a documentary where she said, can't we just have something that represents us?
The answer to that question remains to be seen. The Richmond City Council was to vote on the mayor's plan this past May, but after a majority of members publicly declared they'd vote against it, Mayor Jones removed it from the agenda. Chief of Staff Grant Neely says the mayor is refining the plan and will reintroduce it to the council when, as he puts it, the time is right. We have information about Revitalize RVA, as well as images of the proposed Sacred Ground Memorial District, on our website, metroconnection.org. This next story is also about the slave trade and commemorating the individuals caught up in it. This month, a new memorial opens just south of Old Town Alexandria on the corner of South Washington and Church Street. It honors 1,700 former slaves who escaped to Alexandria during the Civil War. Known officially as contrabands, they had traveled on foot hundreds of miles with little food and no shelter. As more of them arrived and passed away, the federal government designated a parcel of land on the southern edge of town to be the Freedmen's Cemetery. That was 150 years ago this month. But over time, the surrounding area was rezoned, and by the mid-1950s, it was paved over for a gas station and an office building. Then, in the mid-1990s, this same site was about to become the staging area for the impending renovation of the Woodrow Wilson Bridge. That's when the requisite archaeological study revealed the presence of graves, hundreds of graves. Emily Berman brings us the story.
As we walk through the cemetery's iron gates, it's clear that Fran Bromberg, Alexandria's city archaeologist, knows this place inside and out, above ground and below.
We're going to now walk on the path that was the original carriage path into the cemetery.
Most of what we know about this site, she says, comes from archaeological excavation.
When an archaeologist scrapes the top levels off to look for evidence of that coffin or that grave shaft, what they see is an outline in the same configuration as the grave shaft with a different texture and color of dirt in it.
About 15 years ago, a team of archaeologists uncovered 600 burial shafts. Each one is memorialized with a flat stone marker.
This is not just a random placement of gravestones that you see on this site. These are actual markers of burial locations.
Following this discovery, the city, in conjunction with a preservationist group called the Friends of Freedmen Cemetery, raised money to buy the gas station and office building that was there, tear them down, and dedicate a memorial. Audrey Davis, director of the Alexandria Black History Museum, says it's difficult to imagine how locals could allow such a thing to happen.
Looking at it now through our eyes, we'd say it's a sacred site, you need to protect it, but they just weren't thinking. This was a segregated city. I mean, African Americans were here, but they weren't really living in the same areas as whites. Their stores, their churches were not valued in the same way.
That's why it's rather amazing, she says, that we have a complete record of freed men buried in Alexandria from 1863 to 1869. Reverend Albert Gladwin was in charge of the contraband population during and just after the Civil War. He kept a list of who died, where, when, their age, and cause of death. Librarians discovered this list, called the Gladwin Record, in Richmond, in the basement of the Library of Virginia.
Eliza Alexander, Cecilia Armstead.
And that's how genealogists found 140 descendant families and invited them to a formal memorial ceremony earlier this month.
My name is Norman Reynolds. I drove down from Baltimore. My Aunt Carolyn told me that this was going to happen, so I had to be here. There she is right there.
I'm Carolyn Phillips McCray from Oxon Hill, Maryland, but I'm a native Alexandrian. I had an old Bible dating back to 1886 where two of my relatives were married at Alpha Street Baptist, and from that she traced back the roots of other relatives that I had.
I remember coming to the gas station here, and for them to do this is great. It's a great feeling.
Zuni Matima came down from Hagerstown to honor her relatives here. She has quite a few.
There's Thompson, there's Harrison, and there's Branham.
Her great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother was Caroline Branham, Martha Washington's enslaved lady's maid. That was during colonial times, Matima explains. So by the Civil War, Branham had many descendants.
I'm very thankful and very grateful that this is all being done, because how many years did it sit there? And no one knew.
These were 1,700 people who took freedom into their own hands, for themselves and for their families. Now with this memorial, Matima says, their uncommon courage will be an inspiration for many generations to come. I'm Emily Berman.
The Alexandria Black History Museum has an exhibit on contraband history. We have links to that exhibit and photos of Freedmen's Cemetery Memorial on our website, metroconnection.org. After the break, a local woman reveals her struggle with a disorder psychologists are just beginning to understand.
I still haven't gotten myself past the issues that got me here, but at least I'm not stuck, dug under.
And residents of a Columbia Heights apartment building battle a more than 30% increase in rent.
We decided not to pay no rent, so we might have to wind up in court. I don't care. I'm ready to go to court. I'm ready to go to court.
It's just ahead on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5.
WAMU News coverage of labor and employment issues is made possible by your contributions and by Matthew Watson, in memory of Marjorie Watson. And support for WAMU 88.5's coverage of the environment comes from the Wallace Genetic Foundation, dedicated to the promotion of farmland preservation, the reduction of environmental toxins, and the conservation of natural resources.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and welcome back to Metro Connection. This week, we're going below the surface and taking a look at some of the more unseen parts of the D.C. region. For this next story, though, we're not just going below the surface, we're going behind closed doors. In the past decade, the district has lost 50% of its low-cost rental housing stock to condo conversions and luxury renovations. That's according to the D.C. Fiscal Policy Institute. Landlords either buy out low-income tenants through voluntary agreements, or they jack up the rent so high that residents have to move somewhere else. But while many low-income tenants choose to leave, some stick around and fight to hold on to their homes. Lauren Ober brings us this look at one group of residents battling what they see as an effort to push them out.
Howard Proctor is 77 years old. He's lived in a snug one-bedroom apartment at 2724 11th Street Northwest for the past 13 years. He keeps his place tidy. His kitchen is spotless. He makes his bed every day, but he can't keep up with the roaches.
We got traps all over the place for the mice and the bug. Take a look back here in the back, to the side.
He points behind his refrigerator and I have a look.
Oh boy.
You see, understand now?
Oh boy, yeah, those are large roaches.
They're all over the place.
Oh boy.
You put the stuff down and it still comes.
Four huge roaches stick to a trap laid on the floor. But those aren't the only ones in Proctor's apartment. He points behind his radiator and then behind his couch.
See them?
Oh my God.
They got them everywhere.
Oh, they're everywhere.
You understand now?
Yeah.
On the next floor up, Ana Vilma Vasquez shows me evidence of a rodent infestation in her apartment.
Y que vaya a ver el colchón como tan de curtido porque son nuevecitos, porque hasta arriba se trepan los ratones, dígale.
She says rats and mice have burrowed holes in their mattresses and they've had to buy new ones. Her husband says at night he can hear the rodents tunneling as he tries to sleep. For the past 2 years or so, the residents of the 25-unit building have been complaining of uninhabitable conditions like these.
Conditions are really, really bad in that building.
Tamir Ramirez is a tenants' rights organizer with the Latino Economic Development Center.
You have rats, you know, just digging holes in people's furnitures. You have bed bugs. You have holes in the ground from, like, the different construction in the basement. And also the roof needs a lot of repair.
There's also mold, lead paint, and unsafe appliances. With the help of Ramirez, some student lawyers from the University of the District of Columbia, and a number of concerned neighbors, the tenants have been fighting to get these problems addressed. But earlier in the summer, they got some bad news. Come September, the landlord was increasing their rent by a whopping 31.5%. The building's tenants are all low income. Many are Latino. Some are elderly or disabled. Most pay around $900 a month for a one-bedroom unit. In rent-controlled buildings like this one, landlords can't increase rent unless they can prove the property isn't generating enough profit. That's what the owner of 2724 11th Street claimed.
The hardship petition is basically a petition that the landlord can file with the city and say, hey, I'm not making my 12% in here, so I want to increase rent on all the tenants, even elderly and disabled, so I can get that 12% that the city grants me by law to receive as a landlord.
Basically, property owners in the district are guaranteed to make a 12% return on their investments. If they're not, they can petition the city to grant them a waiver so they can raise rent. Ward 1 Councilmember Jim Graham has seen this scenario play out with the same owner at other properties.
It's a situation that we have run across before where the rents, which have been low and thus affordable,
are not supporting the kind of profit that the owner wants. And so one of the responses of the owner is to not make necessary repairs, as if they had no responsibility.
The building is owned by Ellis J. Parker, who lives in Florida. His daughter-in-law, Jennifer Parker, is his D.C. surrogate. Neither responded to repeated requests for comment, nor did Stan Ford, whose company manages the Parkers' properties in the district. The Parkers' rentals are well known to Graham and the D.C. Department of Regulatory and Consumer Affairs for the countless housing and fire code violations they've incurred over the years. Tenants and advocates like Tamir Ramirez suspect the Parkers are trying to push residents out of the building because of two words: condo conversion.
It is a building that could generate a lot of money to whoever has that building and whoever doesn't have tenants living in that building.
In the past decade, DC has seen an explosion of affordable units getting renovated into condos. These conversions are partially to blame for the city's affordable housing crisis. Howard Proctor says the Parker family already tried to force a condo conversion on the tenants of 2724 11th Street, but they declined.
I think they're the one to get us out of here. You understand? All you got to do is read between lines since we turned down their proposal.
The tenants have collectively refused to pay the rent increase, and they're demanding sweeping changes to make the building habitable. Proctor suspects they'll wind up in court, but that's okay, he says. He's ready to fight. I'm Lauren Ober.
We go now from trying to hold on to your home to trying to make it a place you actually want to come home to. Not too long ago, the American Psychiatric Association added a new item to the list of obsessive-compulsive disorders: hoarding disorder. People with hoarding disorder have a hard time throwing things away, be it a stack of old newspapers or a box of broken holiday ornaments. Eventually, many of them come to find that the stuff they've accumulated has begun to take over their homes, maybe even their cars or their offices. Megan Pauley looks at some of the latest research on hoarding and introduces us to a local woman who's trying to rein in her own cluttering compulsions.
Suzanne, whose name has been changed to protect her identity, is the vice president of a large bank and has been living with and managing her bipolar disorder for years. But Suzanne also allowed clutter to accumulate in her house, and eventually it got so bad that she could no longer use one of her bathrooms because it was blocked by piles and piles of clothes.
I could barely walk in the front door. And when that's the first thing you see when you come home, and you know that that's what you're coming home to, it sinks you that much more.
When she was depressed, Suzanne would hole herself up in her upstairs bedroom, allowing fast food trash and dirty clothes to accumulate on the floor. She recently realized it was time to make a change when she started dating again for the first time in years.
How do I tell somebody they can't come to my house?
She hired a company called Stericlean to help her with some serious summer cleaning. I drove out to Suzanne's home in Frederick, Maryland to observe the cleanup process. We start in the basement, designating certain corners to place keepsakes Suzanne hasn't been able to use for years, like her Christmas tree. In other corners, we pile up items to throw away, like empty bottles of laundry detergent.
I'm thinking I don't need my stuffed animals anymore.
Oh, that's, what's his name from,
Eeyore.
Eeyore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I liked Eeyore.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. Relate to him a little bit.
Aww. By the end of the first day, the basement is almost completely cleared out, and the kitchen is a work in progress. The next 2 days will be dedicated to cleaning out the upstairs.
I'm excited to have a new house, and maybe this time I can make my house my home.
Scientists say hoarding is a disorder rooted in the decision-making part of the brain. A 2012 brain imaging study funded by the National Institute of Mental Health looked at hoarding. It found that the anterior cingulate cortex and insula, areas of the brain that handle error monitoring and emotional decisions, overactivated in study participants with hoarding disorder. Dr. David Tolan, the director of the Anxiety Disorder Center at the Institute of Living in Hartford, Connecticut, led the study.
In their brain, everything's important. And so it becomes very hard to make a reasonable decision about whether something is worth keeping or not.
Hoarding was once closely linked to obsessive-compulsive disorder, but Dr. Tolan says it is now more closely correlated with other disorders such as major depressive disorder, anxiety disorder, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. He says researchers are now focusing on treatment, and certain antidepressants such as Effexor are being tested for treating the disorder. Suzanne has been seeing the same therapist for years for her bipolar disorder and depression, and she's trying to restrain herself from falling into old habits like eating in bed and letting her refrigerator get overcluttered.
And well, I still haven't gotten myself past the issues that got me here, but at least now I'm not stuck, dug under. I'm starting from a blank slate to be able to focus more on what I need to work on for me.
Several months after my first visit to Suzanne's, I went back again to see how she's been doing. The decluttering has been a large undertaking, and the work didn't stop once the Steri-Clean crew left. Suzanne initially thought she'd be able to cook dinner for her boyfriend the Tuesday immediately following the deep cleaning, but the kitchen table and counters were still completely covered with cleaning supplies. On my second visit, though, the table was set for dinner, and her upstairs carpet had been replaced.
So
it looks really good.
It's a nice neutral color.
Yeah.
And it's not too brown. I was afraid it
Now that the carpet has been taken care of and her living room is in order, Suzanne is putting some energy towards smaller details, like picking out paint colors for her living room and kitchen, and deciding on artwork for her upstairs bedroom.
So my living room is going to be, it's called Sparkling Sage. It's a pretty little green color.
It's very pretty.
And I really like
it. Suzanne says she's trying to be satisfied with the steady progress she's seeing around her. She's now been able to invite people into her home, and her goal is to host an open house for friends and colleagues someday soon. I'm Megan Pauly.
The DC region is full of resources for people with hoarding disorder. We have a list on our website, metroconnection.org. And now, time to knock on a few doors with our ongoing journey around the region. This week on Door to Door, we'll visit Davidsonville, Maryland, and the Rosemont neighborhood of Alexandria, Virginia.
My name is Melissa Stanton. I'm in my late 40s, and I live in Davidsonville, Maryland. Davidsonville, Maryland is located in Anne Arundel County, right between Washington, D.C. and Annapolis. If you're going on Route 50, we're right in the center. Everybody's house is unique. You know, old houses, little bungalow kind of houses, ranchers. There are many McMansions, and then just very unique farm properties. Davidsonville is zoned, at least my area, residential agricultural. What we have is called a farmette, apparently. It's a few acres, residential, but agricultural, so you're allowed animals. We have 14 chickens, so 13 hens, one rooster. They're my son's chickens, and I actually sell the eggs for him. I bring them into DC, into my office. You can kind of get away without really being away.
My name is Ann Shine. I'm 75 years old, and I live in the Rosemont area of Alexandria. Rosemont is located about 4 blocks from the King Street Metro Station and, as we like to say, in the shadow of the Masonic Temple. I would call it the east end of Alexandria. Rosemont was advertised at the turn of the 20th century as a 15-minute streetcar ride to Washington. It was a bedroom community developed by people from Philadelphia. The Masonic Temple is still a draw for neighbors Its claim to fame is that they still have George Washington's original teeth. They also have a number of other artifacts of his in a very small museum there. But George Washington was a Mason, and this lodge was built to honor him. Rosemont is a great place to live because it is a neighborhood that remains stable, that has truly never really changed since I grew up here as a little girl.
We heard from Melissa Stanton in Davidsonville and Anne Schein in Rosemont. If you think your neighborhood should be part of Door to Door, let us know. You can reach us at metro@wamu.org or send us a tweet. Our handle is @WAMU Metro. In a minute.
Adult females can average about 8 feet and 300 pounds. Smaller adult males average about 7.5 feet and over 200 pounds.
We'll hear about the Potomac swimming creature that might make you need a bigger boat. And we'll shine the spotlight on a new play that really gets you out of your seat.
To get the full experience, you have to go to 9 different places in the city and, like, put yourself out there.
Those stories and more are coming your way on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5. Welcome back to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and this week we're going below the surface and showing a different side of Washington, be it deep underground, behind closed doors, or in the case of this next story.
Okay, you guys, let's look and see where we are.
Before your very eyes.
All right, and so we'll do the same thing that we have been doing. We'll do a chunk, talk about it, do a chunk again, probably do it again, just so Thomas has plenty to play with, and then we'll keep moving through.
And actually, not just before your eyes.
Whenever you're ready.
But before your ears.
Took you long enough. Did you go the scenic route? Stop for a half smoke and a short screw? Don't bother trying to see me. Nobody sees me unless I want them to, and I don't particularly want you to.
We're at the Silver Spring Black Box Theater in a snug, windowless room clustered with microphones and music stands, with Jess Young directing. Sound designer Thomas Sowers is recording actor Jimmy Whalen.
I am the god of hidden things, spirit of shredded files, patron saint of the redacted. We will play at secrets until one of us falls. You win, I'll tell you what you want to know.
Whalen's reading from the script of Walking the City of Silence and Stone, a whole new kind of production for Forum Theater. As artistic director Michael Dove will tell you, the 10-year-old theater company is calling it a walking podcast play.
It's one part audio play, one part installation piece, like found space type of theater piece, but it exists only in your ears.
In other words, you download each of 9 episodes on your portable device of choice and use cues in the audio to make your way around the city. So various spots and landmarks in D.C. become a kind of backdrop, both visually
and orally, with an A, you know, what's happening in the sonic landscape
as the story unfolds. Now, as to what that story actually is, why don't we let playwright Stephen Spotswood explain?
So it starts off as a murder mystery. The listener is witness to a mysterious death that they are then basically recruited to help discover what happened. And you will be given clues, but if I do my job right, you won't figure it out.
From there, it's part ghost story, part love story, and part adventure tale.
Where you do have a hero who is going through trials, and there is that confrontation at the end that will resolve things one way or the other.
But given that Forum is releasing the 9 episodes over 9 months, you'll have to exercise some patience. Now, Spotswood actually wrote his first walking podcast play a few years back for the National New Play Network. That's a DC-based organization fostering new play development across the country.
I had so much fun to be able to use such a large national landscape as my set piece, and also to tell this very intimate, very private story in such a huge space.
I'm glad you decided to walk with me. Walking alone can be a little sad, I think, in a city with so many people. I have a way I like to go. We walk to the other side of 7th Street and then turn left. Be very careful of the cars. They'll run you right over if you give them a chance.
This is a clip from All the Tall Places, Spotswood's two-character piece that takes listeners from Woolly Mammoth Theater in Penn Quarter through the National Gallery of Art Sculpture Garden and over to the Washington Monument. Walking the City of Silence and Stone, on the other hand, involves scores of characters and expands the set, if you will, to a number of locations.
DuPont Circle is one.
The National Portrait Gallery.
The 8th Street Corridor.
The list goes on and on.
I mean, there are a number of goals with this piece. One is just to get the listener out and about in different areas of the city that they might not be familiar with. But the big one is to have them, when this is over, not be able to see the city the same way.
Because as Spotswood points out, the nation's capital has many layers. On top, you can think about this grand federal structure, right?
Giant wheels turning.
Then you have the people who live and work here.
Who may or may not be part of that, but sometimes get kind of crushed underneath it.
And underneath that, he says, you have another stratum.
The disenfranchised, the homeless, the mentally ill, the ones that you don't notice, the ones you don't want to notice. And part of this piece is about making the listener look at the city from a different point of view, maybe from those people's points of view.
Director Jess Young, who moved to Washington 3 years ago, says even just rehearsing and recording the play has her seeing the city with new eyes.
It's really exciting to be pushed to do that. And it's also so needed in our everyday lives. We live so quickly that this is an opportunity to slow down and see things that you don't allow yourself to.
Now, we should note, it's not like you have to go out and about as you listen to the play. You could check it out from the comfort of your own home.
It also has great characters that one can invest in from wherever. So I think an audience member somewhere else, even in the country, could get involved in the story.
But at the same time, says playwright Stephen Spotswood,
there's also a ton of DC insider stuff for people that live here. Not enough that if you don't live here, you won't be able to appreciate it, but I think there's enough to make it fun, real fun.
In fact, says Forum Theater's Michael Dove, in addition to releasing the play online, they're thinking of organizing on-site listening parties.
While we're not doing this in a traditional theater, we do really recognize the fact that theater is really a communal event. And so there's a lot of talk of just getting people to walk the episode together and then maybe have a conversation about it.
And that conversation could reveal a million different interpretations of the play. Because, as Dove says, there are a million different ways to look at Washington.
There are many different DCs, and they sort of all exist on top of and under and behind one another. And I think that what this play does for me is unlock some of those worlds that are a little unseen. And I love the idea that after having experienced this play, that people will ride the metro or walk down 8th Street and just think of that community a little bit differently because they have this new story that will exist in their heads.
Forum Theater will release the first episode of Walking the City of Silence and Stone later this fall. For more information, you can visit our website, metroconnection.org. Move out of the district now and over to Maryland for a story about going below the surface by way of strip mining. Just this week, a coalition of government agencies and bird conservation organizations published a State of the Birds report, which contains some rather unsettling news. Bird populations are declining across several key habitats. But conservation efforts have yielded some positive results and some solutions that may seem a bit unorthodox, at least at first. Environment reporter Jonathan Wilson traveled to Frostburg and has more on the role reclaimed coal mines are playing in efforts to save a songbird called the golden-winged warbler.
You aren't likely to see the golden-winged warbler at your suburban bird feeder. It's a bird that needs open space. But if you do, you won't be disappointed. The bird is beautiful. The golden-winged warbler is a silver-gray bird with brilliant golden-yellow flashes on the top of its head and its wings, of course. It sounds like this. That's a recording from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Getting a live recording in Maryland would be tricky. We're not in golden-winged season, and even if we were, tracking one down might prove difficult anyway.
Well, they're a neat little bird. They're a species of concern. They're running out of habitat, so we're not seeing as many of them as we used to see.
That is Caitlin Ernest, a graduate student in applied ecology and conservation biology at Frostburg State University. She's studying the species for her thesis.
They're hybridizing with another species of bird, which is one of the big concerns. So we were kind of out here seeing if we could find any golden wings or any of the species that they were hybridizing with to see if, you know, what was going on out here at these sites.
Ernest says she did find some warblers this spring, but the birds turned out to be hybrids between golden-winged and blue-winged warblers. Some scientists believe hybridization happens more frequently than we realize and can indicate that a particular species is becoming rarer and thus must mate with another closely related type of bird. The site Caitlin is using for her study is a large tract of land covered with clusters of the 4-foot-tall yellow-flowered plant known as goldenrod. Small trees dot the rolling hills here and there, but this is still basically a grassland. Caitlin's professor, Bruce Ammer, says if you didn't know we were in the Appalachians, you might never guess that earth movers and excavators once dredged these acres for coal.
I would say people from downstate who were never exposed to this, they probably wouldn't look at this and say this was a reclaimed mine. They might actually say this was probably part of a farm.
Gwen Brewer manages science programs for the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. She says up until recently, reclaimed strip mines were seen as a real challenge by biologists because after mining companies were done with the land, the soil was so heavily compacted. That made it hard for any trees to take root, so even decades after mining is complete, many reclaimed mines have more grass and shrubbery than mature trees.
What that means to us as wildlife habitat is that they sort of become natural areas that maintain themselves for a longer period of time without trees. And for some species, that's a good thing, so it's a little bit of a mix.
Brewer says the golden-winged warbler is one of those species.
Sort of an irony that some of our habitats for some of our rare species end up being in these areas that were mined and planted and that maintain themselves in that state because the trees don't like to grow in there because of the way that they mined it.
Brewer says DNR doesn't know exactly how many reclaimed strip mines currently support breeding populations of golden-winged warblers, or even how many could sustain the birds with a little habitat restoration. She says right now, Maryland is likely home to fewer than 200 pairs of golden wings each year. But these unlikely havens of reclaimed mines are definitely playing a role in making sure the birds come back each spring. And Gwen Brewer says DNR scientists are actively studying ways to make once barren land even more hospitable to songbirds and other species on the brink. I'm Jonathan Wilson.
Want to see a golden-winged warbler for yourself and find out what a reclaimed strip mine looks like? We have pictures on our website, metroconnection.org. We'll wrap up today's show by heading underwater, specifically under the water of the Potomac River. Turns out there's a certain creature in the Potomac that can grow up to 13 feet long and weigh in at more than 300 pounds. You can find it as far south as Brazil and as far north as the Gulf of Maine. Julie Alderman brings us the story of bull sharks here in the D.C. region.
You're not going to find sharks swimming in the tidal basin next to the National Mall. But if you travel to where the Potomac River and the Chesapeake Bay meet in southern Maryland, you might be lucky enough to spot one, or catch one, just like John William Dean did.
just a regular day's fishing.
Dean, a commercial fisherman for 40 years, caught two bull sharks just over a year ago. We're on his boat, about 100 yards from Point Lookout State Park in Scotland, Maryland. Dean sets up six large nets for fish, but a bull shark can destroy those nets in the blink of an eye.
He tore the net up a lot. The way it works with animal like that, they have to keep the forward motion swimming. And when you corner him up and stop him from moving forward, he'll like suffocate.
Dean says animal rights groups confronted him about why he decided to kill the shark instead of setting it free. But he points out if it had lived, it would have been a public safety issue.
Right there, no distance at all, is a public swimming area. You know, and if we had turned them loose and somebody had got bitten or maimed, we'd have felt terrible.
Back on land, I speak with Holly Bourbon, the curator of large fish exhibits at the National Aquarium in Baltimore. She explains how bull sharks are able to live in the Potomac River, which is entirely freshwater.
Bull sharks are very unique because they do have a tolerance to be able to swim and live in fresh water. Typically, they like to lay their young in freshwater habitats. So the females, when they're pregnant, will actually come up into freshwater bodies.
As they grow up, bull sharks move out to the ocean to consume larger prey.
And they can eat a variety of things, from fish to invertebrates to crustaceans to dolphins to other sharks to turtles.
But female sharks return to freshwater every year during July, August, and September. And as Bourbon will tell you, bull sharks are dangerous. Since they swim in shallow waters, they will often come in contact with humans.
Because they're a near coastal shark and they like to spend a lot of their time near shore, and your chances of a bull shark potentially coming upon humans and there being an interaction is obviously greater.
It's especially important to exercise caution when these animals are hungry.
With sharks, you know, you want to avoid the dusk and dawn when they're going to be feeding. Oftentimes they like those high energy areas where obviously surfers like to surf. It can be also areas where sharks like to hunt. You don't want to swim alone. You don't want to, if you see a lot of bait jumping or breaking at the surface, there could be something, whether it's a shark or a large other fish, you know, hunting it. You want to avoid those areas.
But Martin Gary with the Potomac River Fisheries Commission emphasizes that the presence of bull sharks shouldn't keep anyone from enjoying the water. In fact, it doesn't seem like bull sharks have bothered anyone in the Potomac River or the Chesapeake Bay.
The mere fact that we've never had a documented shark attack or fatality in the Chesapeake Bay, yet we know there's numbers of these animals present, probably gives you some indication that they generally leave anything other than their preferred prey, which are fish, alone.
But, says Gary, spotting a shark can make you realize and appreciate the diversity of the Potomac River and the surrounding area.
I really think my advice would be not to worry about it and appreciate the fact that we have a broad diversity of fish species, including sharks, that use the Chesapeake Bay.
Even though shark encounters are extremely rare in the Potomac River and Chesapeake Bay, fisherman John Dean is not at all surprised or scared by what he's seen. As he says,
just normal fishing. You just got to be cautious handling something like that. You know, it's not an everyday occurrence. And you just got to be cautious.
In the past 5 years, only one person in the United States has been killed by a bull shark off the coast of Florida. No shark-related fatalities or injuries from the D.C. area have been recorded. I'm Julie Alderman.
Curious about that spot where John William Dean caught his bull sharks last year? We have photos on our website, metroconnection.org. That's Metro Connection for this week. We heard from WAMU's Jonathan Wilson, Emily Berman, Lauren Ober, and Julie Alderman, along with reporter Megan Pauley. WAMU's managing editor of news is Memo Lyons. Metro Connection's managing producer is Tara Boyle. Lauren Landau is our editorial assistant. Our intern is Julie Alderman. This week's door-to-door producer is John Hines. Thanks, as always, to the WAMU engineering and digital media teams for their help with production and the Metro Connection website. Our theme song, Every Little Bit Hurts, and our door-to-door theme, No Girl, are from the album It Was Easy by Title Tracks and used with permission of the Ernest Jennings Record Company. If you missed part of today's show, you can hear the whole thing on our website, metroconnection.org. Just click This Week on Metro Connection or subscribe to our podcast. We're also on iTunes, Stitcher, and the NPR News app. We hope you can tune in this time next week when WAMU will present the latest documentary in Kavitha Cardozo's Breaking Ground series. This time we'll enter the world of our nation's military children. We'll visit some of the bases they call home, explore the schools that educate them, and learn how some of these 2 million young people are coping with parents deployed and lost overseas. The week after that, Metro Connection is back with a brand new edition, an entire hour exploring what we're calling the G word. Gentrification. Our reporters are hard at work on this one, so I hope you can join us. Till then, I'm Rebecca Shear, and thanks for listening to Metro Connection, a production of WAMU 88.5 News.